Well, hi everyone, thank you coming out to Portland's Friends of Mystery. We meet 5 times a year. Please come back in the future if you would like. I'm here today with Deb Miller Landau, the gender-bending author of A Devil Went Down to Georgia, Race, Power, Privilege, and the Murder of Lita McClinton, a book Oprah Daily ranked number one on its list of best true crime books of all time. In 2024, it was optioned for a limited series by Universal Studios and was recently nominated for the Edgar Allan Poe Award for Best Fact Crime. Deb's book has been featured in Atlanta Magazine, People, Newsweek, NPR's All Things Considered, and was the inspiration of a recent 2-hour episode of ABC's 2020, in which she appeared as an honor expert. She's written dozens of magazine articles and travel guidebooks for Lonely Planet Publication. She now lives in Portland, Oregon. Thank you for coming out today, Deb.
Thanks for having me.
So how much did you celebrate when Oprah Daily ranked your book as the number one best true crime books of all time?
I remember that day. I opened it up, and I can't remember now if my publicist let me know, but I opened it up, and it showed my book as number one, and I thought it was a joke. And I kind of freaked out. It was amazing, because it was on the list of, you know, Anne Rule's book was on there, and Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. And so I think it was a pretty subjective list, but it was pretty awesome to be on there for sure. Yeah.
So I'm under the impression you've been following Lita McClinton's story since 2004. Why tell the story, and especially why did you decide to tell it now?
So Lita McClinton was a black socialite in Atlanta who was murdered in 1987. Fast forward 15 years later, and I was working as a writer for Atlanta Magazine in Atlanta, Georgia, and the crime had still been unsolved, largely unsolved. And so my editor for Atlanta Magazine wanted somebody with fresh eyes who didn't know the case, because everyone in Atlanta had opinions about it and knew all about it, but I hadn't even heard of it, and asked me to do a retrospective on the case. So I sort of had, you know, dug into it 15 years after the fact then, and got really, really, really into the research and spent quite a long time putting together all the pieces, because it was a crazy roller coaster of a case, but also it involved an interracial couple who was very wealthy in Atlanta. They got together at a time when that was just not happening. And so it was a really fascinating case. And so my article, my feature article published in Atlanta Magazine, that story was later anthologized in the Best American Crime Writing. So it was kind of a big deal for me. And so I kind of carried this box of files around for a really long time, unable to kind of get rid of it. And then, you know, fast forward to much, much later, I'm now living in Portland. It's the summer of the pandemic and the summer of George Floyd, and I'm noticing, you know, I'm going down to the protests, the Black Lives Matter protests, and my experience of it was that it was very pretty joyful and pretty upbeat and safe until, you know, the federal, you know, troops came in. But at the time, it was really interesting how it was framed in the news, you know, in the national news, that there were riots in the streets of Portland, and those, you know, that really only happened, as we all know, sort of after the federal intervention. So it made me really think about how stories are told, especially around race. And in the following months, or in that sort of heated summer, I started looking at, you know, my own experience as a white person in this country and how I've benefited from it and how I've, you know, participated in upholding, you know, a white dominant culture. And it got me really thinking about the McClinton family, because when I first met them at the time, I didn't know black people like the McClinton family. Most of my experience with black folks, to be honest, was through the media. And so I saw sort of the you know, the tropes of black culture, and here was this whole huge community and this family, but this whole huge community of super, super educated black folks who were working really, really hard to figure out the sort of puzzle of civil rights, who were really participating in the building of Atlanta in a way that wasn't happening anywhere else in the country. So it had mattered a lot to me, and they were sort of the most pivotal sort of black experience that I had had up until that point. And that kind of made me go back and decide, you know, maybe it's time to open that box.
So who was Lita McClinton? You mentioned she was a socialite, but...
So Lita McClinton was born into a relatively well-to-do family in Atlanta in 1952. And in, you know, the first 20 years of her lifetime, she lived through... She went, you know, she was would go shopping with her mother, and they would have to use the colored entrances and the colored bathrooms. And in her lifetime, she saw... I've got a list here because it's so much. She saw... the passing of the Brown versus the Board of Education, which desegregated schools, even though that took a really long time to take hold in Atlanta. She saw the birth of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the Morehouse College sit-ins, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and then Loving versus Virginia, which passed in 1967 when she was, you know, 15 years old. And that was the federal legislation that repealed miscegenation laws that forbade blacks and whites to marry. And that didn't take hold in Atlanta until 1972. And so it was a pretty, you know, that's 20 years of her life. She lived in a pretty different, you know, time in civil rights history. And then she was, you know, she went to debutante balls. She was part of the Jack and Jill Club, which is a sort of affluent, you know, to cultivate young men and women and young black men and women, and they have, you know, balls and they learn etiquette and they wear white. And so she was sort of part of an upper echelon of, you know, her neighbors were Martin Luther King Jr. and Andrew Young, and her parents sort of moved in those circles. So she, you know, had a pretty, you know, interesting life in that she was very educated and then also sort of experienced a lot of, you know, white folks and black folks, because her parents were sort of in that you know, influential sphere. And then she went to Spelman College, which is a HBCU and an all-women's black college in Atlanta. And it's part of the Atlanta University Center that includes Morehouse and Clark and Morehouse Medical School. And it's sort of like this nexus of black power in Atlanta like nowhere else in the country. And so she was really a part of that. So she was sort of grew up in this kind of black is beautiful, but she also was there for the Atlanta's, you know, too busy to hate sort of phase. And so, but Atlanta, for as much as it sort of mixes, it's still a pretty segregated place, was then and kind of still is today.
So the subtitle of your book is Race, Power, Privilege, and the Murder of Lita McClinton. What role does race play in the story?
So Lita, I'll just sort of continue on the story of Lita's life. Lita, in 1976, she was working, she had graduated college, was totally into fashion, even though her degree was in political science, and she didn't want to be a lawyer or a political scientist in any way, and was working at a boutique in Atlanta when this quirky white guy with a New England accent came in and was just completely taken with her. And his name was James Sullivan, and he was from Boston and had moved to Georgia because he had inherited his uncle's liquor distributorship in Macon, which is 80 miles south of Atlanta. And they made a very unlikely couple. Her family was like, who's this guy? Like, this is not what we want for our daughter. And not... they found him sort of a little bit brash and arrogant, but they also knew what it would be like to be the black part of an interracial couple in the South. And but Lita and Jim fell hard for each other, and you know, 6 months after they met, they got married. And you know, that sort of kind of set the stage for what the rest of her life was going to be like. Jim at first was, you know, today we'd sort of call it love bombing. You know, he was, gave her lots of gifts and lots of, showered her with lots of attention. And then started to become strange. Like, he would just be really, really frugal at home and then really lavish outside when people were watching. He began to have affairs. He was sort of a master gaslighter, so she would sort of, you know, suspect that he was cheating, and he would, you know, deny, and then, you know, sort of buy expensive jewelry for her, and it kind of went around in the circle. And she'd fought so hard for the marriage that she sort of couldn't give up on it, and they were both Catholic. And so she stayed in this marriage to Jim for you know, almost 10 years. And then at one point they were living in Macon, and then at one point Jim decides he's tired of Macon and he buys a mansion in Palm Beach, Florida without telling Lita, and he moves her there. And at the time they're living in Shirley Hills in Macon, which is a very white affluent place, and it's sort of like he's brought this black wife to kind of show that he can in some ways. And then he goes and buys a mansion that's like down the road from Mar-a-Lago, and at the time just 0.1% of the population in Palm Beach, Florida was black, and that was probably a live-in nanny or a maid. And so she, you know, tried to make it work there. They bought this, they lived in a 17,000 square foot mansion, and, you know, are living this kind of huge life, but behind that facade things are starting to crumble again, and she just feels really isolated and alone. Basically, she convinces Jim to buy a place in Atlanta because they go back and forth a lot because her family's all still there. So they have a condo in Atlanta, and she begins spending more and more time there. And when she comes home one time, she finds a woman's lingerie in their marital bed. And I say in the book, it's the bra that broke the camel's back. And she's like, I'm done. I'm out. So while he's away, she hitches a U-Haul trailer, packs some things, and hitches the trailer to her Mercedes and drives to Atlanta and files for divorce. So, you know, they're having this very, very contentious divorce, and Jim is trying to get the divorce litigated in Florida because there a judge decides on a divorce, and he's believing that judge in Florida would probably be a wealthy white guy like himself and more lenient towards him, whereas in Atlanta they have a jury decides the outcome of a divorce, and so that would be more of Lita's peers. It would probably be a jury that would be made up of black and white people. So he tries that for the longest time. He makes all these sort of allegations against her. And finally, they're battling for 2 years, and I'm totally not answering your question, but that's fine. I will get there. they're battling it out for 2 years, and the day a judge in Atlanta was to decide on the division of assets, they had this like prenup and postnup and this very sort of contentious agreement that was a little dubious. On the day that a judge was to decide on the division of assets, she was going to go to court that day. It was a Friday. It was kind of this like gray, rainy day in Atlanta in January. She had just turned 35 years old, and she gets the doorbell rings early in the morning, and she opens up the door, and eyewitnesses later said that they heard her say good morning, and there was a man standing there with a, you know, white box, like a long stem roses would be in, with a pink bow around it, and he sort of pushes his way into the foyer and pulls a gun out of his jacket pocket, shoots once and it misses her, and then investigators later figure that she sort of holds up the box to block the shot, which of course, you know, is never going to work, and he takes another shot and shoots her and flees. And then, so 20 minutes later, she dies at Piedmont Hospital, the hospital that she was born at. And just to set the stage, she was living in Buckhead, Georgia, which is the sort of whitest, most affluent neighborhood in all of Atlanta and all of Georgia. And she's a black woman. And so when the detectives get there, right off the bat, and these are black detectives, they're sort of looking around at this like beautifully furnished place, very affluent, and they're like, what's going on here? So sort of right off the bat, it was treated in a way that, it was just treated differently because she was a black woman. And so that it was sort of implied on lots of levels, and I go into it a lot in the book, but that because she was black, that it was somehow, you know, her fault for being murdered. And so her funeral is held on the following Monday, which is the second ever Martin Luther King Jr. Day, a federal holiday. And the, you know, streets are packed, people are flowing into the streets. It's you know, so many people have shown up to show their respects. And the one person who wasn't there was James Sullivan, her husband. So I'm gonna just pause there and then, you know, see what you have to say.
What were the challenges of researching such an old case?
So I think it's really interesting because most of the, you know, certainly the police report, all of the subsequent investigations, you know, it was very, very boots on the ground police work. And so they're doing, you know, the police reports are all written. And so, you know, I had to put in FOIA requests, Freedom of Information Act requests for files. And that is a maddening thing to do because you never know if you're going to get something back or not. And they'll say, you know, they'll send something saying, oh, we're delayed. And sometimes nothing comes. And then sometimes, you know, you get this big packet of material. And so I got this big packet of stuff at one point from the Atlanta Police Department, and almost all of it was illegible. And so I was like, ah! And so I got my hands on sort of parts of bits and pieces. So it was very much like putting together a puzzle. Like, you know, so I'd get pieces from there. And then there were several different court cases that happened in relation to this case, including their divorce, and then, you know, several subsequent trials. And so I poked through and tried to find, you know, transcripts of depositions and testimony. And I really leaned heavily on the memories of FBI detectives and Georgia Bureau of Investigation agents. And then also on the reporting of, you know, for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, for the Palm Beach Post, because it's really interesting, as a former reporter, you know, you're really, really immersed in, like, what's happening at the time, and you don't realize that what you're writing about is later going to become a piece that fits into that puzzle, right? So now I can go back and read through all of, like, there was a guy named Bill Montgomery from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution who sort of stayed with this case for like more than a decade. And from what he first wrote to what he last wrote, you kind of see the evolution of the case. And of course, he wouldn't have been able to see it at the time, right? Because he was totally in it. So, you know, you start to be able to put together things that way. But it was a lot of just different sources and trying to figure out, you know, you think about it now, it would be really hard to commit a crime. You know, in terms of electronic footprint, there's cameras everywhere. You don't know where they are, where they're not. There are sensors on cars now. There's cell phone trackers. None of that existed back then, and including there wasn't a connected, you know, AFIS system that the national database for fingerprints didn't exist. No DNA testing was being done. There was really not a internet that people were using. And so, you know, it was really just looking through. It was kind of putting myself into the position of what if I didn't have any of that, and then having to put it all sort of together. So it was kind of very challenging, but also really fun to just try to put all these pieces together. And then every now and again, I would be reading through like pages and pages and pages of, like, you know, transcripts from court. And most court cases are really boring, and you get a lot of just blah 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 stuff, but every now and again there's a nugget, and so you sort of have to go through it all because you might miss the nuggets. And then when you get a nugget, you're like, oh my god. So, you know, it's really cool because this case happened over a long period of time, and it's 37 years ago now, but it took a really long time to have it be solved. And then when you are able to, like, take a look at it now from this perspective, the perspective of time, the perspective of the things that we're looking at today in terms of power dynamics between men and women, domestic abuse, you know, racial situations, inequities in the justice system, white, powerful white men versus black women, like, we're in it now. And so being able to look at it through the lenses of what we're looking at today and through the you know, technology that we have today too, is makes it really, really interesting. And a lot of people are only, you know, one of the things that I found interesting is that you think, like, how did they, what took so long? And I can talk about that a little bit, but you realize that, like, these detectives work on this for a little while and then they get busy. And so in Atlanta in 1987, when Lita was murdered, she was murdered on January 16th. And at the time, it was the 97th murder of the year already. So 16 days in. So it's a violent time in Atlanta. A lot of that is sort of gang related in pockets of the city. So it was very unusual to have a murder in Buckhead. But they're busy, the cops. And so you realize that they're moving on to other things, and then they pass it off to the FBI, and the FBI gets busy with other things, or Joe Blow retires, or this guy gets moved somewhere else, and then it goes to somebody else. And that's how cases get cold, you know? And you start to sort of see, like, yeah, there's nobody, it's sort of astonishing. There's nobody holding on to the thread. And so, you know, it's really been interesting to work with, or, you know, to work with some of these FBI people who are like, I never knew the whole story from beginning to end. I only knew my time in it. And so being able to sort of see it and cover the whole thing was really, really cool to be able to do that. And also a way to honor Lita and Lita's family in a way that, you know, the narrative of what people know, it's sort of Lita was this kind of cardboard character. You know, she was really into fashion and she was beautiful and she was this and that. But, you know, her story was always sort of incomplete because it's being told in that way too. So it feels good to be able to tell her story in a fully sort of alive way.
So you met with the hitman in this case. What was that like? And why did you feel that talking with him was important?
So the hitman is a guy named Tony Harwood. And Tony was hired to kill Lita, and he wasn't apprehended. They didn't know about him. He vanished after that day. He vanished. There was no trace of him. No fingerprints. No. There were three eyewitnesses: the person who sold the flowers, the next door neighbor, and then a neighbor across the street. And then another woman who was driving by. So four different eyewitnesses, and each one of them had a totally different description that they gave to the police artist. And so they had these three composite drawings of the you know, people involved. So for the longest time, the cops thought there were three people: the driver, the shooter, and the flower buyer, and that they were three distinct people. And they sort of vanished. And it wasn't until 11 years later when a woman in Texas caught wind of a television show, of an extra episode, where the now very cold case, they're sort of revisiting it, and the parents are making pleas for information, lawyers are making pleas for information. And this woman says, and there's photos of James Sullivan, and she said, I know that guy. My then boyfriend got an envelope full of money from him at a truck stop in Florida 11 years ago. And, you know, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation at that point had so many leads and so many sort of false leads that they were chasing down. But this one sounded really legit. And so they go hightail it to Texas and meet up with this woman, Belinda. And Belinda tells them, you know, her boyfriend at the time, Tony Harwood, took this money. And so they wire her up, and she has a series of phone calls with her ex-boyfriend Tony, and slowly they get enough information, and then they go get Tony. So when they pick up Tony, he basically tells them that you know, Lita's husband James Sullivan paid him to take, he said, quote, take care of Lita. And as soon as that happened, James Sullivan vanished. So Tony is now sitting in prison, sort of waiting around. There, he's potentially going to get the death penalty. It's still on the table in Georgia. He's given up Jim Sullivan, but Jim Sullivan has vanished. And suddenly he's on the FBI's most wanted list. Interpol's involved. There's an international manhunt, but he vanishes. So the sort of the case again sits in limbo. Eventually, Tony got a plea agreement, but he did spend 20 years in prison and got out in 2018. So when I started researching the book, I had so many questions, like who were the accomplices, that all sorts of questions that were never answered by me or anyone else. And then, you know, why did Tony do it? How did it happen? All of that stuff. So I really wanted to hear his side of the story. So I, you know, tried to find him. It's not easy to find somebody who's necessarily been in prison, but I knew what town he lived in before that. And then I started sort of looking for him on Facebook and Instagram and all these other things, and eventually found an email that landed for him. But I didn't, you know, he sent me, the first email he sent me was months after, and he said, you know, I would really, you know, it would be really good if, he sounds like, who's the guy with the big mustache? Sam Elliott. Sounds exactly like Sam Elliott. This big booming voice. He says, well, it'd be really good if somebody would like to tell the truth, because it was never came out right. And I was like, okay. And I said, well, you know, can we talk? And then again, he'd ghost for a long time. And then I'm at the grocery store buying milk, and my phone rings, and it's a unlisted number. And so I answer, I'm just, hello, you know, and this is Tony Harwood. And I'm like, so we end up having a series of long conversations. He, to this day, contends that he was not the one to pull the trigger. And the book goes really into that and into Tony's story. But I really wanted to talk to him and see what he had to say. And so I met up with him. I flew to Charlotte, North Carolina, and he lived in a town outside of that. I was headed to Atlanta for some research, and I said, you know, can we meet up? And he said, we can try, you know. And so the day that I arrived, he had ghosted me for the last like week or two, so I wasn't really hopeful that it would happen. But I rented the only car I could get at the airport. The rental car was a minivan, so I take my minivan to this tiny town in the middle of nowhere, and I'm driving around, and I've taken a red eye from Portland. So it's super, super early in the morning, and I'm driving around this town sort of trying to get the lay of the land. And it's, you know, there's like rusted out cars and washing machines on the side of the road, and it's got its main street. And I'm sort of texting him the whole time, nothing, 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 nothing. And I'm exhausted. And so I go and I pull into this park, and it's January and it's really, really cold. There's nobody around, and I'm sitting in my minivan, and I am parked, there's a lake, and I'm like, what am I gonna do? And I think it's only like 9 o'clock in the morning. So I have a little snooze, and then I wake up and I'm like, screw it, I'm gonna call him. And I called him, and he answered right away. And he said, where are you at? And I said, well, I'm here. And he said, yeah, but where? And I said, well, I'm at the park, but I'd scoped out a few places, like coffee shops in town, where it would be good to, like, I could record it, but it would be public and, you know, safe and warm. And so I said, well, I'm at the park right now. And he said, I'll be there in 5 minutes. And click, and hangs up the phone. And I was like, oh, shit. And literally nobody in the world knows where I am. So I pick up my phone, and my friend in Atlanta, who I'm about to go stay with, I send her a text, meeting hitman in 5, and you know, putting my location tracker on, and she's like, sends back, you know, a wide-eyed emoji. And so a few minutes later, Tony Harwood rolls up in this crappy old pickup truck, and in the passenger seat, he's got a woman. And she's, you know, tiny. She's maybe 90 pounds. She's got a hot pink tote bag with an oxygen tank in it. And he's smoking. And he gets out of the car, and I'd seen all these pictures and footage, but he's old now. And so he's sort of smaller and kind of, you know, he's only like 72, but he's sort of not the Tony of my imagination and the Tony of the time. And I said, well, you know, it's kind of cold to sit outside. Do you want to? And I'm super nervous. I don't, you know, I'm way too much coffee. I've like not enough sleep and I'm not really sure what I'm doing. And I said, do you want to go to the, you know, Joe's and I'll buy you guys breakfast or whatever? He's like, nope, we'll get in your van. So three of us climb into the minivan. He goes in the passenger seat. I go in the driver's seat. And the woman who had just got out of the hospital and had emphysema 3 was sitting in the back seat. And he talked for 3 hours solid. And, you know, gave me all sorts of, told me all about his life, told me all about how, you know, that day haunts him every moment of his life. And then, you know, also sort of told me about his life. And he grew up, everyone in his family had either spent time in prison or had drug addiction or alcohol addiction and extreme poverty. And not to say that anybody who grows up in that environment, you know, goes and takes money and, you know, is hired to kill people, but it humanized him in a way that I that wasn't accessible to me having not met him. So it was sort of also kind of confusing because he was a character and also, you know, he had orchestrated the murder of this woman who I'd come to really know and love and feel protective of. So it was a really crazy time, and we've kept in touch, and it's a weird thing. I mean, it's a lot of crazy, so you know, you got to be protective of yourself about how much crazy you're gonna allow in. But yeah, it felt like meeting him was important.
So when you meet someone like Tony, how do you gauge if they're and you interview them, how do you gauge when they're telling the truth or when their pants are on fire?
It's a really, really good question. I think of myself as a pretty good built-in bullshit detector, but I don't know. I think about all the things that he said to me and then, you know, try to square that with all of the things that the cops say or the FBI guys say or the people who arrested him say. And it's still, to this day, I, in some ways, want to believe the things that he says, and some ways think, am I just being naive and missing it entirely? So I think, and also, you know, he grew up in, like, he had a grade 9 education, ninth grade education. And after that, he went to prison for 7 years and for like B&E and things like that, and tried to escape twice, got more time. So he was in prison for a long time, for a good chunk of his life. And so he probably knows how to bullshit people. So a lot of times I felt like, you know, he's totally bullshitting me, but then other times I felt like, why is he still sticking so much to all of the things that he's saying when he could just be, he's served his time, he's not gonna get any more time for this crime. Why not just go off into the night and, you know, live your life? But he's so adamant about the things that he says. So I find it very fascinating. I don't know, sometimes I don't know if how to read, you know, I think of myself as a pretty good judge of character but it opened my mind to think, like, you know, how do you really know?
Mm-hmm. So even though this is, you know, you wrote about a crime that happened in the past, you wrote the book in the present tense. Why did you decide to do that?
Yeah, so I was really doing the research for a long time, and then finally I realized, like, oh my God, if I don't start really getting into the writing, I'm not gonna make my deadline. And so I started doing getting the writing, and it was a lot of information. So trying to get all that organized and figure out, like, am I doing this straight up chronologically? Am I gonna bounce around in time? And making those kinds of decisions, like, as writers, you know, that's like some of the hardest thing is, like, how are you going to reveal And then how do you, once you know what's happening, how do you put yourself in the position of the reader to figure out like how they're going to experience the story, right? Like how it's all going to unfold for them. So I was sort of really reckoning with those questions. And then I was writing, because it's an old story and everyone that I was interviewing was talking in past tense, and of course, you know, it's talking about a long time ago. And I was writing it all in past tense, and I was probably 3 or 4 chapters in, and I felt this like distance from it that I didn't like, and I felt like I was too far removed from it. And two things happened. One was I decided, what if I'm just going to try it for a couple of chapters, just rewriting it in present tense. And once I did that, everything changed. Like it just felt so much more sort of present. It's technically really challenging because you're quoting people who are speaking in past tense, and how do you manage that? So, you know, there were several times where I questioned whether that was the right decision or not, but it definitely made it a lot more immediate. And then the second thing that I did when I was writing, so for nonfiction, you write a book proposal, and the book proposal is no joke in itself. It's usually around 60 pages. It requires a lot of research, but you try to sell your book based on the proposal, whereas in fiction writing, you write the whole thing first, and then you try to sell that. So I'd written this proposal, and that proposal that I wrote got me an agent. The agent said, you know, your proposal's really good, but we're gonna work to make it better. And I was like, sure, okay, yeah, a couple weeks. 6 months later, we're still working on the proposal. Finally, the proposal it's good, but it also was a really good forcing function. It really, you know, what do I have? What don't I know? Where am I gonna get all the pieces and stuff? So it really pushed that. So my agent had said during that process, like, I really think it'd be good for you to be a character in the book, like to your experience of finding this book. And I was like so resistant to that. One is, as a white woman writing about a black woman, the last thing I wanted to do was sort of center it on me. I wanted the focus to stay on Lita and on her family. But as I was working on in the writing, I started realizing that so many of the things that I was learning about her, I was also learning things about myself in the process. And so I started, it's not heavily, I'm not in it a lot, but you kind of go through a little bit in places what I'm going through in the research of it. And I think that made it a lot closer to me. So those two decisions were pretty pivotal, I think, in how the book, you know, that everyone I talk to is like, I read it in a few days or a weekend or whatever. It's fast. Like it goes, because it's in present tense, it feels really immediate and there's a lot of action happening. So yeah, that was pretty much the reason for the present tense.
So how did Lita's family react to you wanting to tell her story and the eventual book?
So I had met Lita's parents back in 2004 when I first wrote about it for Atlanta Magazine, and they're like exceptional people. Her dad, Emery McClinton, was the head of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Transportation, so he was a big executive at the Department of Transportation. Her mother was on the Georgia State Legislature, and they lived in this big, huge sort of colonial home in Atlanta. And you know, at the time that I first met them, they were very kind and polite, and but they'd been through the ringer, you know. And so then when I come back 20 years later and basically say, hey, I want to, you know, write this book, I was really scared to approach them, because I thought, what if they say no? What if they, you know, don't want anything to do with it? I certainly don't want to write the book without them. But I really feared that they would be like, we are so done with this. And so by the time I actually met, so Lita's mother is, you know, just total matriarch of the family, and she agreed to meet with me, and I went to their home in Atlanta. And Emery, by this point, was in the other room and had, you know, was frail, and they were 91. Both the same age. They were 91 at the time, and they'd been together since the fourth grade. They met in the fourth grade, so they'd been married for more than 70 years. And I sat down with Lita's mom, and she was so like incredibly clear and with it and gracious. And but like I write in the book, I didn't know if I'd have 10 minutes with her or 2 hours. And I ended up spending the afternoon with her. And then I also, but Lita has a brother and a sister, and they weren't that interested and sort of deferred to their mom. And so that felt a little bit strange too. Just, you know, I wanted everybody interested and eager. But I also got it. They never really were public people, very private. They'd been through so much. When I asked Lita's mom for photos of Lita or photos of the wedding, she said, I really don't have very many left, because she'd given them to news people through the years and they'd promised to give them back and never sent them back. And so, you know, they'd been through a lot, but she knew of me from before. And if she, you know, I don't think they remembered me from the time, but it felt really important to have their kind of her blessing at least. And then Lita's nephew, who was in utero when she was murdered, so his sister, her sister's son, unborn son, when Lita was murdered, so he's now the age, how do I say this, the age of the time since she's been gone, so she's been dead for 37 years and he's 37 years old. So he kind of became this great ally, and it was really interesting because he, you know, always knew about his aunt and was, you know, a part of the, he was a teenager when, and sitting in courtrooms and things like that through a lot of it. But of course he didn't know the whole story, he didn't know the whole backstory. So he was sort of learning about his aunt through this experience too. And it really made me think, Lita's best friend's daughter also had connected with her. And you know, she wanted to learn more too, because you don't sort of sit around the family and talk about that day or that those, you know, what happened before and stuff like that. So it was really interesting to sort of realize that when somebody is murdered or somebody goes missing from a family, they don't go away. You know, they're still there. And so how are people still experiencing them? So it felt really important to have the family. But, you know, also I really wanted to you know, Lita's mom said to me, stay away from sensationalism, because I think especially with true crime nowadays, like the temptation is so there to sensationalize and sexy it up. But she said, I don't want you to do that and tell an authentic story. You know, these are real people. So that's what I tried to do.
So kind of on the writerly side, like how do you craft tension with something like a non, like true crime, when, you know, people do know the ending?
Yeah, that's a great question, because that's the thing too. It's like you know who, you know, and so you're like, well, why would I bother reading the book? Because I already know what happens going in. But you don't really know what happens. Like you, to actually sort of see how it all unfolds and to, and I think that again, like the writing in present tense also helped with that. Like there's just a lot of moments throughout where you're like, ah, what? Ooh, what's happening? And I mean, it's just such a full story that it was sort of easy to just let those moments exist for themselves. And there was just so much, so many peaks and valleys along the way for the family.
So I know you've done a lot of travel writing. Do you think that helped you write this?
Yeah, I love to write about place. It's like one of my favorite things when I read a book, to be immersed in a setting. I just recently taught a class through Literary Arts called Places and Spaces that's all about writing about, you know, setting, I guess, and also just what little things tell you about history or, you know, understanding how a place is how it grows, how it changes. That's all really, really, I love that. And so with travel writing is kind of interesting too, because you sort of plummet into a place and you don't know your way around. And it's like another puzzle that you just have to kind of figure out. And so as a travel book writer, that's always like this sort of moment of tension where you're just like, I don't know this yet. I don't understand this yet. And then you get to, after spending a lot of time and talking to a lot of people and doing a lot of things, you sort of get to a place where you're like, oh, I know this now. And it's this like really like lovely transition that happens that starts with tension and then becomes kind of a resolution. So I just have always loved being able to use place as a way, like, so for example, in this book, like, when Lita was murdered, it was only a few years after the child murders in Atlanta happened, and that was when, I think it was 21 or 22, black children were being murdered throughout the city. And so it was a time that if you were a black family, like, you did not let your children go out by themselves, like, anywhere in the city. And it was just this crazy tension time, I mean, for mothers, you know, just scared and fearful. And then it was also a time where things were sort of changing a little bit in the South. They were just about to host the first ever Democratic convention in Atlanta. It was like this like party time. AIDS was happening. There was like all sorts of just different things that were happening in the city culturally that were important to the story. And so I love to capture that kind of history and cultural sort of relevancy that tells you so much about a place and the people who live in it.
Would you, before we open for questions, would you read an excerpt?
Sure. Okay. So frequently I read the first sort of half of the prologue. Some of that is what I've already discussed a little bit today. So, and it's just a couple pages. We don't have my readers, but we'll give it a go. Okay. So you heard a bit of this. But I'm sitting in a rented Pacifica minivan in a desolate parking lot at City Lake Park in Albemarle, North Carolina, waiting to meet a man recently released from prison for orchestrating a murder. For decades, newspaper headlines across the country called him the hitman. Hitman found, suspected hitman charged in killing a Buckhead socialite, hitman released. I spent months hunting him down before he finally called me, and we've talked or emailed several times since. While it would be refreshing to have the opportunity to meet with someone that is all about learning the truth and printing it, he said, I'm not sure if you have the resources to do the things that I would require of you. I had looked over my shoulder in a fit of nonsensical panic. Is anyone seeing this? But it was an opening, even though I had no idea what he was talking about. He knows I'm coming, but he's ghosted me for the past couple of weeks, and now I fear I've made the trip for nothing. I've taken a red eye to Charlotte from my home in Oregon, achieved only a couple of hours of neck-jerking airplane sleep, and now find myself in a tiny town in the middle of nowhere. For what? I first wrote a retrospective about the brutal 1987 murder of Lita McClinton Sullivan for Atlanta Magazine in 2004. It was a case that shook the city, later the country, and still later the world. A black socialite from a politically powerful black Atlanta family gunned down in broad daylight in one of the most upscale, whitest neighborhoods in Georgia. For a decade, the case went cold, unnervingly frigid. It became fodder for newspapers and magazines, was featured on television shows. Journalists like me followed it for years. Lawyers didn't sleep, cops took it to their graves, and Lita's family pushed and bent until they almost broke. I'd been a writer for a decade when I got the Atlanta Magazine assignment, but this was the first true crime story I had ever covered, and I fell into it hard. I got pulled in by reading police reports, news stories, and the endless court documents, but what really climbed under my skin was the humanity and depravity of it all. What makes people become who they are? What leads us to the choices we make? Then the story impacted me so much, I still had the banker's box full of files upon whose lid I'd scrawled Sullivan with a black Sharpie decades prior. The box survived several moves, a flooded basement, a storage locker, by divorce, neglect. In it were yellowing court documents, hand-scrawled notes, business cards of long-retired police detectives, and a photo of Lita given to me by her parents. It's the same one that graces the cover of this book. I'd periodically pull out that photo and wonder what she was thinking in that moment, what she thought in so many moments before and after. I kept in loose touch with the McClinton family lawyers and their private investigator. Sometimes I'd Google James Sullivan. Every time I thought about pitching the box, I'd put the lid on and shove it back on a shelf, sensing there was more left to the story. Then, as the world was in lockdown in May of 2020, George Floyd was murdered by police in Minneapolis, and something in me shifted. Just a few years prior, I had joined millions of women who'd take to the streets wearing homemade pussy hats to fight against misogyny and protect the rights of women. Then brave women took to the highways of social media as the Me Too movement shone light in the faces of miscreant men and demanded a change in the power imbalance of Hollywood and beyond. Now I joined other outraged protesters who flooded the streets shouting how Black Lives Mattered, only to be tear gassed and harangued as angry mobs. In the eye-stinging haze of pepper spray and the reverb that followed that summer, I began thinking about Lita and the McClinton family in this new day of reckoning. How clearly had I seen Lita the first time I wrote this story? I felt increasingly called to not re-examine not only Lita's life and death, but my own exploration of it too. Around this time, I reached out to my old Atlanta magazine editor and we talked for hours. Finally, in the middle of the call, he said in his slow Georgia accent, "Well, sounds like maybe it's time to write a book." There it was, the reason I'd carried that box around all those years. The responsibility of reopening it felt both essential and monumental. As I shifted through the papers, I began to slowly realize that the story I thought I knew wasn't the whole story. I spent the past few years drowning in court documents, grasping to get my hands on information that evaporated years ago, clinging to the faded memories of retired cops, investigators, reporters, family members, and attorneys. Many people are no longer alive. Others don't return my calls. Still others can't or don't want to remember. It's still too painful. My walls are decorated with sticky notes that keep falling to the floor. The more I learn, it seems, the less I know. So here I am, rubbing crusty bits of sleep from the tender crannies of my eyeballs in a rented minivan in a tiny town in the middle of nowhere, trying to talk to a hitman. If North Carolina is the rough shape of a revolver pointing west, Albemarle, the county, the Stanley County seat, is just north of the trigger. I've driven all around, past junkyards with broken cars and rusted washing machines, past the home of Kelly Pickler sign in the courthouse square, celebrating the American Idol contestant who escaped this town, past the colonial homes, deserted textile mills, and unabashed cemeteries on the side of the road, and I've done some Googling. This little agricultural town about an hour east of Charlotte grew up around the production and manufacturing of cotton. For decades, everyone worked at the mill, bagging sacks of raw cotton, spinning fiber into yarn, attaching toes to socks at the hosiery mills. Since the textile mills closed in the 1980s, the town has grappled to redefine itself. A lot of families here struggle to make ends meet. It's January 13th, 2023, and unseasonably cold. No one is out save for a couple of weathered souls walking into the forest playing disc golf. I check my phone again, still no text from the hitman. I feel a mix of relief and disappointment. I'm not entirely sure what I'm hoping he'll tell me, other than his side of the story. I sigh, scroll to the Lita album and the photos app on my phone, and look at her pensive, beautiful face. I take a deep breath, look at Lita one last time, and think, all right, let's do this. I'll just stop there.
Audience questions, and I will repeat them for the microphone, just for you.
Well, so I got one. You mentioned getting texts from Tony the Hitman, who seems to be taking issue with some aspects of what you produce. Is there anybody else that was maybe put out or actively upset by what you wrote? I mean, have you gotten any kind of pushback like that?
A recap, was there any pushback or people upset by what she wrote other than Tony the Hitman?
Well, even Tony's not really upset. I think he just wants his ideas out there. So he told me that he's going to publish his own book. So yeah, we'll hold tight for that one. No, honestly, I've had, it's been so unbelievably gratifying. I've had several members of the McClinton family who I never even knew existed reach out and say, thank you for writing this book. Thank you for representing her and our family. I've had lots of law enforcement people, sort of say, atta girl, you did a good job or whatever. So that feels really good. And because especially writing, there was one point when I was working on the book proposal and I said to my agent, you know what, I'm just gonna write a fictional version of this story. Fuck this. I can't do this nonfiction. It's too much. There's too much information. There's too much to get wrong, you know? And my agent, Rick, just sort of kind of said, yeah, no. So get back to it, you'll be fine. And so I really mean it when I say every single sentence in the book, it comes from research. There's potentially a little bit of creative license in the creating of scenes, but even those come from descriptions gleaned from, you know, news reports or testimonies or anything like that. But absolutely everything comes from research. And so early on, I knew that I needed to double, triple check everything. Because like there was a television show about the case and they got the day of the murder wrong. And I remember watching it and going like, what? Like they, you know, and there were just a lot of things like that where there were so many opportunities to get information wrong. And so I kind of just said, I'm going to make sure that it's all right. But it's a lot. Like it's, you know, it's not a huge book, but it's a lot of research.
Mm-hmm. Did your publisher do much fact checking as well, or was it mostly on you?
No, that was the weird thing too, because this is my first book like this. I had written for magazines mostly, and magazine fact checking, for people who don't know, it's super exhaustive. They, you know, anybody who's quoted, they'll have a fact checker call and say, the writer said you said this, did you say this? And they'll say yes or no, or whatever. So every little detail, and when you write a book, they do no fact checking. Like, they just can't, right? Because there's so much in there. So I was like, wait, what? Like, because we're gonna, you know. So again, you know, the onus is on the writer to make sure that it's all right.
Yeah. So I know we've asked you, or you talked to them about where his money all went, and then you had someone was assigned to it, one lawyer was assigned to it, and then they, you know, passed it on to someone else. And so any update on that?
Just an update of what happened to the husband's money.
So when James Sullivan was eventually apprehended after a several year international manhunt, lawyers for the family just sort of realized that he had squirreled away his fortune in offshore accounts. And they tried very hard for very many years to figure out where that money was, and they never could figure that out. And when I was down doing some research in Florida, I met with two of the main attorneys for the family died. One of them died in 2020 and one in 2022. So I was, you know, so that was hard because they weren't around to talk with. And so I was talking to this appellate attorney who'd been involved in one of the cases, and the family had won a wrongful death suit in Florida against James Sullivan. And in civil court cases, for people who don't know, the penalty is not jail time, but it's financial. So they wanted to take away the one thing that kept kind of, you know, that meant so much to him and his money, and they wanted to take that away. They didn't want it for themselves, but they wanted him not to have it. So they won a $4 million judgment, but they never ever received a dime of that. Today's dollars, that judgment is worth about $18.5 million. And so that judgment is an open judgment against him that he owes to Lita's estate, and which is administered by a government body in Atlanta. But so that has to be renewed every 7 years in order to stay relevant. So when I was down in Florida with this lawyer, I said, oh, so we're doing the math. And I said, so it needs to be renewed this year. And he said, yeah, I guess so. And I said, well, who's doing it? He's like, I don't know. And so, you know, because nobody's got the thread. And, or so we thought. So we sort of, I did some digging around and found that one of the widows of one of the lawyers, who was also a lawyer herself, now retired, had recently gone into the box of files to make sure that the renewal keeps going. So now it you know, another, it's like 7 or 10 years it needs to go by before it gets renewed again. But ostensibly, what that means is if they ever find James Sullivan's money, like when he dies, that money will still be owed to the family. So he sort of like has won on that level, and that really rankles a lot of people. And it's still this sort of open investigation that, you know, there's a little group of us keeping an eye on. So.
Has writing this book and experiencing all of the attention and awards and just conversations that you've had, how's it changed you as a person?
How has writing this book changed Deb as a person?
So it's really interesting because when you write a book, you're by yourself in your little hovel for years, and then suddenly the book publishes and you're supposed to talk about it. And I, from months before it kind of came out, I was so panicked about that because I was like, well, what am I supposed to say? And what do people think that I should say? I was really scared to talk about race. I was really scared that people were gonna say, why you? And they have. And I've had a lot of really, really amazing conversations. And I think what I landed on, and it sounds a little cheesy, but it's so true that the more like I put aside what I think I should say and what people expect me to say and just speak from the heart and be honest every single time, it's the way to go. And it's just like, it's been a good reminder of that, both when I do like public things, but also just in life. Like, let's just stop with the play acting and the mask wearing and the bullshit. And so it's been good for that, you know, just really like reminding whenever I start feeling a little like over my skis. Is that a Canadian expression? But there you guys get. But when I start feeling like I'm sort of in above my head, I just go like, just go back to what you know and be honest.
Well, thank you for speaking with us tonight. Friends of Mystery will be back in March with Glenn Eric Hamilton, and we'll be back in May with Emiko Jean and Jamie Lee Song. So please come out if you'd like.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.